My hands usually shake before I start to cry, and I can't cry in front of everyone. I follow Tori out of the tattoo place and down the path to the pit floor. All the people that were milling around earlier are gathered by the ledge now, and the air smells potently of alcohol. The woman in front of me lurches to the right, losing her balance and then erupts into giggles as she falls against the man next to her. Tori grabs my arm and steers me away. I find Uriah, Will, and Christina standing among the other initiates. Christina's eyes are swollen. Uriah is holding a silver flask. He offers it to me. I shake my head.
"Surprise, surprise," says Molly from behind me. She nudges Peter with her elbow. "Once a stiff, always a stiff."
I should ignore her. Her opinion shouldn't matter to me.
"I read an interesting article today," she says, leaning closer to my ear.
"Something about your dad,
and the real reason you left your old faction." Defending myself isn't the most important thing on my mind, but it is the easiest one to address. I twist, and my fist connects with her jaw. My knuckles sting from the impact. I don't remember deciding to punch her. I don't remember forming a fist. She lunges at me, her hands outstretched, but she doesn't get far. Will grabs her collar and pulls her back. He looks from her to me and says, "Quit it, both of you." Part of me wishes that he hadn't stopped her. A fight would be a welcome distraction, especially now that Eric is climbing onto a box next to the railing. I face him, crossing my arms to keep myself steady. I wonder what he'll say. In abnegation, no one has committed suicide in recent memory. But the faction's stance on it is clear. Suicide, to them, is an act of selfishness. Someone who is truly selfless does not think of himself often enough to desire death. No one would say that out loud, if it happened, but everyone would think it.
"Quiet down, everyone!"
shouts Eric. Someone hits what sounds like a gong, and the shouts gradually stop, though the mutters don't. Eric says,
"Thank you. As you know, we're here because Albert, an initiate, jumped into the chasm last night."
The mutters stop too, leaving just the rush of water in the chasm.
"We do not know why," says Eric, "and it would be easy to mourn the loss of him tonight. But we did not choose a life of ease when we became dauntless. And the truth of it is..."
Eric smiles. If I didn't know him, I would think that smile is genuine. But I do know him.
"The truth is, Albert is now exploring an unknown, uncertain place. He leaped into vicious waters to get there. Who among us is brave enough to venture into that darkness without knowing what lies beyond it? Albert was not yet one of our members, but we can be assured that he was one of our bravest."
A cry rises from the center of the crowd, and a whoop. The Dauntless cheer at varying pitches, high and low, bright and deep. Their roar mimics the roar of the water. Christina takes the flask from Uriah and drinks. Will slides his arm around her shoulders and pulls her to his side. Voices fill my ears.
"We will celebrate him now and remember him always," yells Eric.
Someone hands him a dark bottle and he lifts it.
"To Albert the Courageous!"
"To Albert!" shouts the crowd.
Arms lift all around me, and the Dauntless chant his name.
"Albert! Albert! Albert!"
They chant until his name no longer sounds like his name. It sounds like the primal scream of an ancient race. I turn away from the railing. I cannot stand this any longer. I don't know where I'm going. I suspect that I am not going anywhere at all, just away. I walk down a dark hallway. At the end is the drinking fountain, bathed in the blue glow of the light above it. I shake my head. Courageous? Courageous would have been admitting weakness and leaving Dauntless, no matter what shame accompanied it. Pride is what killed Al.
and it is the flaw in every dauntless heart. It is in mine. Triss. A jolt goes through me, and I turn around. Four stands behind me, just inside the blue circle of light. It gives him an eerie look, shading his eye sockets and casting shadows under his cheekbones. What are you doing here? I ask. Shouldn't you be paying your respects? I say it like it tastes bad, and I have to spit it out.
Shouldn't you? He says.
He steps toward me, and I see his eyes again. They look black in this light. Can't pay respect when you don't have any, I reply. I feel a twinge of guilt and shake my head. I didn't mean that.
Ah.
Judging by the look he gives me, he doesn't believe me. I don't blame him.
This is ridiculous, I say,
heat rushing into my cheeks.
He throws himself off a ledge and Eric's calling it brave? Eric, who tried to have you throw knives at Al's head?
I taste bile. Eric's false smiles, his artificial words, his twisted ideals. They make me want to be sick.
He wasn't brave. He was depressed and a coward, and he almost killed me. Is that the kind of thing we respect here?
What do you want them to do? He says. Condemn him? Al's already dead. He can't hear it, and it's too late.
It's not about Al, I snap.
It's about everyone watching. Everyone who now sees hurling themselves into the chasm as a viable option. I mean, why not do it if everyone calls you a hero afterward? Why not do it if everyone will remember your name? It's... I can't. I shake my head. My face burns and my heart pounds. And I try to keep myself under control, but I can't.
This would never have happened in abnegation,
I almost shout.
None of it. Never. This place warped him and ruined him. And I don't care if saying that makes me a stiff. I don't care. I don't care.
Four's eyes shift to the wall above the drinking fountain.
Careful, Triss,
he says, his eyes still on the wall.
Is that all you can say?
I demand, scowling at him.
That I should be careful? That's it? You're as bad as the candor, you know that?
He grabs my arm and drags me away from the drinking fountain. His hand hurts my arm, but I'm not strong enough to pull away. His face is so close to mine that I can see a few freckles spotting his nose.
I'm not going to say this again, so listen carefully.
He sets his hands on my shoulders, his fingers pressing, squeezing. I feel small.
They are watching you. You, in particular.
Let go of me, I say weakly. His fingers spring apart and he straightens. Some of the weight on my chest lifts now that he isn't touching me. I fear his shifting moods. They show me something unstable inside of him, and instability is dangerous.
Are they watching you, too?
I say, so quietly he wouldn't be able to hear me if he wasn't standing so close. He doesn't answer my question.
I keep trying to help you, he says, but you refuse to be helped.
Oh, right. Your help, I say, stabbing my ear with a knife and taunting me and yelling at me more than you yell at anyone else, it sure is helpful.
Taunting you? You mean when I threw the knives? I wasn't taunting you, he snaps.
I was reminding you that if you failed, someone else would have to take your place. I cup the back of my neck with my hand and think back to the knife incident. Every time he spoke, it was to remind me that if I gave up, Al would have to take my place in front of the target.
Why?
I say.
Because you're from abnegation, he says. And it's when you're acting selflessly that you are at your bravest.
I understand now. He wasn't persuading me to give up. He was reminding me why I couldn't. Because I needed to protect Al. The thought makes me ache now. Protect Al. My friend. My attacker. I can't hate Al as much as I want to. I can't forgive him either.
If I were you, I would do a better job of pretending that selfless impulse is going away, he says. Because if the wrong people discover it, Well, it won't be good for you. Why? Why do they care about my intentions? Intentions are the only thing they care about. They try to make you think they care about what you do, but they don't. They don't want you to act a certain way. They want you to think a certain way. So you're easy to understand. So you won't pose a threat to them. He presses a hand to the wall next to my head and leans into it. His shirt is just tight enough that I can see his collarbone and the faint depression between his shoulder muscle and his bicep. I wish I was taller. If I was tall, my narrow build would be described as willowy instead of childish, and he might not see me as a little sister he needs to protect. I don't want him to see me as his sister. I don't understand, I say. Why they care what I think as long as I'm acting how they want me to. You're acting how they want you to now, he says. But what happens when your abnegation-wired brain tells you to do something else, something they don't want? I don't have an answer to that. And I don't even know if he's right about me. Am I wired like the abnegation or the dauntless? Maybe the answer is neither. Maybe I am wired like the divergent. I might not need you to help me. Ever think about that? I say. I'm not weak, you know. I can do this on my own. He shakes his head. You think my first instinct is to protect you, because you're small or a girl or a stiff? But you're wrong. He leans his face close to mine and wraps his fingers around my chin. His hand smells like metal. When was the last time he held a gun? Or a knife? My skin tingles at the point of contact, like he's transmitting electricity through his skin. My first instinct is to push you until you break, just to see how hard I have to press, he says, his fingers squeezing at the word break. My body tenses at the edge in his voice, so I am coiled as tight as a spring, and I forget to breathe. His dark eyes lifting to mine, he adds, but I resist it. Why? I swallow hard. Why? Is that your first instinct? Fear doesn't shut you down. It wakes you up. I've seen it. It's fascinating. He releases me but doesn't pull away. His hand grazing my jaw, my neck. Sometimes I just want to see it again. Want to see you awake. I set my hands on his waist. I can't remember deciding to do that. But I also can't move away. I pull myself against his chest, wrapping my arms around him. My fingers skim the muscles of his back. After a moment, he touches the small of my back, pressing me closer, and smooths his other hand over my hair. I feel small again, but this time, it doesn't scare me. I squeeze my eyes shut. He doesn't scare me anymore. Should I be crying? I ask, my voice muffled by his shirt. Is there something wrong with me? The simulations drove a crack through Al so wide he could not mend it. Why not me? Why am I not like him? And why does that thought make me feel so uneasy, like I'm teetering on a ledge myself? You think I know anything about tears? He says quietly. I close my eyes. I don't expect Four to reassure me, and he makes no effort to. But I feel better standing here than I did out there among the people who are my friends, my faction. I press my forehead to his shoulder. If I had forgiven him, I say, do you think he would be alive now? I don't know, he replies. He presses his hand to my cheek, and I turn my face into it, keeping my eyes closed. I feel like it's my fault. It isn't your fault, he says, touching his forehead to mine. But I should have. I should have forgiven him. Maybe. Maybe there's more we all could have done, he says. But we just have to let the guilt remind us to do better next time. I frown and pull back. That is a lesson that members of abnegation learn. Guilt as a tool, rather than a weapon against the self. It is a line straight from one of my father's lectures at our weekly meetings. What faction did you come from, Four? It doesn't matter, he replies,
His eyes lowered. This is where I am now. Something you would do well to remember for yourself. He gives me a conflicted look and touches his lips to my forehead, right between my eyebrows. I close my eyes. I don't understand this, whatever it is. But I don't want to ruin it, so I say nothing. He doesn't move. He just stays there with his mouth pressed to my skin. And I stay there with my hands on his waist for a long time.
Chapter 25. I stand with Will and Christina at the railing overlooking the chasm, late at night after most of the Dauntless have gone to sleep. Both my shoulders sting from the tattoo needle. We all got new tattoos a half hour ago. Tori was the only one in the tattoo place, so I felt safe getting the symbol of abnegation. A pair of hands, palms up as if to help someone stand, bounded by a circle, on my right shoulder. I know it was a risk, especially after all that's happened, but that symbol is a part of my identity, and it felt important to me that I wear it on my skin. I step up on one of the barrier's crossbars, pressing my hips to the railing to keep my balance. This is where Al stood. I look down into the chasm, at the black water, at the jagged rocks. Water hits the wall and sprays up, misting my face. Was he afraid when he stood here? Or was he so determined to jump that it was easy? Christina hands me a stack of paper. I got a copy of every report the erudite have released in the last 6 months. Throwing them into the chasm won't get rid of them forever, but it might make me feel better. I stare at the first one. On it is a picture of Janine, the erudite representative. Her sharp but attractive eyes stare back at me. Have you ever met her? I ask Will. Christina crumples the first report into a ball and hurls it into the water. Janine? Once, he replies. He takes the next report and tears it to shreds. The pieces float into the river. He does it without Christina's malice. I get the feeling that the only reason he's participating is to prove to me that he doesn't agree with his former faction's tactics. Whether he believes what they're saying or not is unclear, and I am afraid to ask. Before she was a leader, she worked with my sister. They were trying to develop a longer-lasting serum for the simulations, he says. Janine's so smart you can see it even before she says anything. Like a walking, talking computer. What? I fling one of the pages over the railing, pressing my lips together. I should just ask. What do you think about what she has to say? He shrugs. I don't know. Maybe it's a good idea to have more than one faction in control of the government. And maybe it would be nice if we had more cars and fresh fruit and... You do realize there's no secret warehouse where all that stuff is kept, right? I ask, my face getting hot. Yes, I do. He says, I just think that comfort and prosperity are not a priority for abnegation, and maybe they would be if the other factions were involved in our decision-making. Because giving an erudite boy a car is more important than giving food to the factionless? I snap. Hey now, says Christina, brushing Will's shoulder with her fingers. This is supposed to be a light-hearted session of symbolic document destruction, not a political debate. I bite back what I was about to say, and stare at the stack of paper in my hands. Will and Christina share a lot of idle touches lately. I've noticed it. Have they? All that stuff she said about your dad, though, he says, makes me kind of hate her. Can't imagine what good can come of saying such terrible things. I can. If Janine can make people believe that my father and all the other abnegation leaders are corrupt and awful... She has support for whatever revolution she wants to start, if that's really her plan. But I don't want to argue again, so I just nod and throw the remaining sheets into the chasm. They drift back and forth, until they find the water. They will be filtered out at the chasm wall and discarded. It's bedtime, Christina says, smiling. Ready to go back? I think I want to put Peter's hand in a bowl of warm water to make him pee tonight. I turn away from the chasm and see movement on the right side of the pit.
A figure climbs toward the glass ceiling, and judging by the smooth way he walks, like his feet barely leave the ground, I know it's Four.
That sounds great, but I have to talk to Four about something, I say, pointing toward the shadow ascending the path.
Her eyes follow my hand.
Are you sure you should be running around here alone at night? She asks.
I won't be alone. I'll be with Four.
I bite my lip. Christina is looking at Will, and he is looking back at her. Neither of them is really listening to me.
All right, Christina says distantly.
Well, I'll see you later, then.
Christina and Will walk toward the dormitories. Christina tousling Will's hair, and Will jabbing her in the ribs.
For a second, I watch them. I feel like I am witnessing the beginning of something, but I'm not sure what it will be.
I jog to the path on the right side of the pit and start to climb. I try to make my footsteps as quiet as possible. Unlike Christina, I don't find it difficult to lie. I don't intend to talk to Four. At least, not until I find out where he's going, late at night, in the glass building above us. I run quietly, breathless when I reach the stairs, and stand at one end of the glass room while Four stands at the other. Through the windows I see the city lights, glowing now, but petering out even as I look at them. They are supposed to turn off at midnight. Across the room, Four stands at the door to the fear landscape. He holds a black box in one hand and a syringe in the other.
Since you're here, he says, without looking over his shoulder, you might as well go in with me.
I bite my lip. Into your fear landscape?
Yes.
As I walk toward him, I ask, I can do that?
The serum connects you to the program, he says, but the program determines whose landscape you go through. And right now, it's set to put us through mine.
You would let me see that?
Why else do you think I'm going in? He asks quietly.
He doesn't lift his eyes.
There are some things I want to show you.
He holds up the syringe, and I tilt my head to better expose my neck. I feel sharp pain when the needle goes in, but I'm used to it now. When he's done, he offers me the black box. In it is another syringe.
I've never done this before, I say as I take it out of the box.
I don't want to hurt him.
Right here, he says, touching a spot on his neck with his fingernail.
I stand on my tiptoes and push the needle in, my hand shaking a little. He doesn't even flinch. He keeps his eyes on me the whole time, and when I'm done, puts both syringes in the box and sets it by the door. He knew that I would follow him up here. Knew or hoped. Either way is fine with me.
He offers me his hand and I slide mine into it. His fingers are cold and brittle. I feel like there is something I should say, but I am too stunned and can't come up with any words.
He opens the door with his free hand, and I follow him into the dark. I am now used to entering unknown places without hesitation. I keep my breaths even and hold firmly to Four's hand.
See if you can figure out why they call me Four, he says.
The door clicks shut behind us, taking all the light with it. The air is cold in the hallway. I feel each particle enter my lungs. I inch closer to him so my arm is against his, and my chin is near his shoulder.
What's your real name? I ask.
See if you can figure that out, too.
The simulation takes us. The ground I stand on is no longer made of cement. It creaks like metal. Light pours in from all angles, and the city unfolds around us. Glass buildings and the arc of train tracks, and we are high above it. I haven't seen a blue sky in a long time, so when it spreads out above me, I feel the breath catch in my lungs, and the effect is dizzying. Then the wind starts. It blows so hard I have to lean against Four to stay on my feet. He removes his hand from mine and wraps his arm around my shoulders instead. At first I think it's to protect me, but no. He's having trouble breathing, and he needs me to steady him. He forces breath in and out through an open mouth, and his teeth are clenched. The height is beautiful to me, but if it's here, it is one of his worst nightmares.
We have to jump off, right?
I shout over the wind. He nods.
On three, okay?
Another nod.
One, two, three!
I pull him with me as I burst into a run. After we take the first step, the rest is easy. We both sprint off the edge of the building. We fall like two stones, fast, the air pushing back at us, the ground growing beneath us. Then the scene disappears, and I am on my hands and knees on the floor, grinning. I love that rush the day I chose Dauntless, and I love it now. Next to me, Four gasps and presses a hand to his chest. I get up and help him to his feet. What's next? It's... Something solid hits my spine. I slam into Four, my head hitting his collarbone. Walls appear on my left and my right. The space is so narrow that Four has to pull his arms into his chest to fit. A ceiling slams onto the walls around us with a crack, and Four hunches over, groaning. The room is just big enough to accommodate his size, and no bigger. Confinement, I say. He makes a guttural noise. I tilt my head and pull back enough to look at him. I can barely see his face. It's so dark, and the air is close. We share breaths. He grimaces like he's in pain. Hey, I say. It's okay. Here. I guide his arms around my body so he has more space. He clutches at my back and puts his face next to mine, still hunched over. His body is warm, but I feel only his bones and the muscle that wraps around them. Nothing yields beneath me. My cheeks get hot. Can he tell that I'm still built like a child? This is the first time I'm happy I'm so small, I laugh. If I joke, maybe I can calm him down and distract myself. Mm-hmm, he says. His voice sounds strained. We can't break out of here, I say. It's easier to face the fear head-on, right? I don't wait for a response. So what you need to do is make the space smaller. Make it worse so it gets better, right?
Yes.
It is a tight, tense little word. Okay. We'll have to crouch then. Ready? I squeeze his waist to pull him down with me. I feel the hard line of his rib against my hand and hear the screech of one wood plank against another as the ceiling inches down with us. I realize that we won't fit with all the space between us, so I turn and curl into a ball, my spine against his chest. One of his knees is bent next to my head, and the other is curled beneath me, so I'm sitting on his ankle. We are a jumble of limbs. I feel a harsh breath against my ear.
Ah, he says. His voice raspy. This is worse. This is definitely...
Shh, I say. Arms around me. Obediently, he slips both arms around my waist. I smile at the wall. I am not enjoying this. I am not even a little bit. No. The simulation measures your fear response, I say softly. I'm just repeating what he told us, but reminding him might help him. So if you can calm your heartbeat down, it will move on to the next one, remember? So try to forget that we're here.
Yeah.
I feel his lips move against my ear as he speaks, and heat courses through me.
That easy, huh?
You know, most boys would enjoy being trapped in close quarters with a girl. I roll my eyes.
Not claustrophobic people, Triss.
He sounds desperate now. Okay, okay. I set my hand on top of his and guide it to my chest, so it's right over my heart. Feel my heartbeat. Can you feel it?
Yes.
Feel how steady it is? It's fast.
Yes, well, that has nothing to do with the box.
I wince as soon as I'm done speaking. I just admitted to something. Hopefully he doesn't realize that. Every time you feel me breathe, you breathe. Focus on that.
Okay.
I breathe deeply, and his chest rises and falls with mine. After a few seconds of this, I say calmly, Why don't you tell me where this fear comes from? Maybe talking about it will help us, somehow. I don't know how, but it sounds right.
Okay.
He breathes with me again. This one is from my fantastic childhood. Childhood punishments. The tiny closet upstairs. I press my lips together. I remember being punished. Sent to my room without dinner, deprived of this or that, firm scoldings. I was never shut in a closet. The cruelty smarts. My chest aches for him. I don't know what to say, so I try to keep it casual. My mother kept our winter coats in our closet. He gasps. I don't really want to talk about it anymore.
Okay.
Then,
I can talk. Ask me something.
Okay. He laughs shakily in my ear. Why is your heart racing, Triss? I cringe and say,
well, I search for an excuse that doesn't involve his arms being around me.
I barely know you.
Not good enough.
I barely know you, and I'm crammed up against you in a box for. What do you think?
If we were in your fair landscape, he says, would I be in it?
I'm not afraid of you.
Of course you're not.
But that's not what I meant.
He laughs again, and when he does, the walls break apart with a crack and fall away, leaving us in a circle of light.
Four sighs and lifts his arms from my body. I scramble to my feet and brush myself off, though I haven't accumulated any dirt that I'm aware of. I wipe my palms on my jeans. My back feels cold from the sudden absence of him. He stands in front of me. He's grinning, and I'm not sure I like the look in his eyes.
Maybe you were cut out for candor, he says,
because you're a terrible liar.
I think my aptitude test ruled that one out pretty well.
He shakes his head. The aptitude test tells you nothing. I narrow my eyes.
What are you trying to tell me?
Your test isn't the reason you ended up dauntless?
Excitement runs through me, like the blood in my veins, propelled by the hope that he might confirm that he is divergent, that he is like me, that we can figure out what it means together.
Not exactly, no, he says.
He looks over his shoulder and his voice trails off. A woman stands a few yards away, pointing a gun at us. She is completely still, her features plain. If we walked away right now, I would not remember her. To my right, a table appears. On it is a gun and a single bullet.
Why isn't she shooting us?
Oh, I think. The fear is unrelated to the threat to his life. It has to do with the gun on the table.
You have to kill her, I say softly. Every single time.
She isn't real.
She looks real.
He bites his lip.
It feels real.
If she was real, she would have killed you already.
It's okay. He nods.
I'll just do it.
This one's not so bad. Not as much panic involved.
Not as much panic, but far more dread. I can see it in his eyes as he picks up the gun and opens the chamber, like he's done it 1,000 times. And maybe he has. He clicks the bullet into the chamber and holds the gun out in front of him, both hands around it. He squeezes one eye shut and breathes slowly in. As he exhales, he fires, and the woman's head whips back. I see a flash of red and look away. I hear her crumple to the floor. Four's gun drops with a thump. We stare at her fallen body. What he said is true. It does feel real.
Don't be ridiculous.
I grab his arm.
Come on, I say. Let's go. Keep moving.
After another tug, he comes out of his daze and follows me. As we pass the table, the woman's body disappears, except in my memory and his.
What would it be like to kill someone every time I went through my landscape?
Maybe I'll find out.
But something puzzles me. These are supposed to be Four's worst fears, and though he panicked in the box and on the roof, he killed the woman without much difficulty. It seems like the simulation is grasping at any fears it can find within him, and it hasn't found much.
Here we go, he whispers.
A dark figure moves ahead of us, creeping along the edge of the circle of light, waiting for us to take another step. Who is it? Who frequents Four's nightmares? The man who emerges is tall and slim, with hair cut close to his scalp. He holds his hands behind his back, and he wears the gray clothes of abnegation.
Marcus, I whisper.
Here's the part, Four says, his voice shaking, where you figure out my name.
Is he?
I look from Marcus, who walks slowly toward us, to Four, who inches slowly back, and everything comes together. Marcus had a son who joined Dauntless. His name was Tobias.
Marcus shows us his hands. A belt is curled around one of his fists.
Slowly he unwinds it from his fingers.
This is for your own good, he says,
and his voice echoes a dozen times. A dozen Marcuses press into the circle of light, all holding the same belt, with the same blank expression. When the Marcuses blink again, their eyes turn into empty black pits. The belts slither along the floor, which is now white tile. A shiver crawls up my spine. The erudite accused Marcus of cruelty. For once, the erudite were right. I look at Four, Tobias, and he seems frozen. His posture sags. He looks years older. He looks years younger. The first Marcus yanks his arm back, the belt sailing over his shoulder as he prepares to strike. Tobias shrinks back, throwing his arms up to protect his face. I dart in front of him, and the belt cracks against my wrist, wrapping around it. A hot pain races up my arm to my elbow. I grit my teeth and pull as hard as I can. Marcus loses his grip, so I unwrap the belt and grab it by the buckle. I swing my arm as fast as I can, my shoulder socket burning from the sudden motion, and the belt strikes Marcus's shoulder. He yells and lunges at me with outstretched hands, with fingernails that look like claws. Tobias pushes me behind him so he stands between me and Marcus. He looks angry, not afraid. All the Marcuses vanish. The lights come on, revealing a long, narrow room with busted brick walls and a cement floor. That's it? I say. Those were your worst fears?
Why do you only have four? My voice trails off.
Only four fears.
Oh, I look over my shoulder at him.
That's why they call you.
The words leave me when I see his expression. His eyes are wide and seem almost vulnerable under the room's lights. His lips are parted. If we were not here, I would describe the look as awe. But I don't understand why he would be looking at me in awe.
He wraps his hand around my elbow, his thumb pressing to the soft skin above my forearm, and tugs me toward him. The skin around my wrist still stings, like the belt was real, but it is as pale as the rest of me. His lips slowly move against my cheek, then his arms tighten around my shoulders, and he buries his face in my neck, breathing against my collarbone. I stand stiffly for a second, and then loop my arms around him and sigh.
Hey, I say softly. We got through it.
He lifts his head and slips his fingers through my hair, tucking it behind my ear. We stare at each other in silence. His fingers move absently over a lock of my hair.
You got me through it, he says finally.
Well, my throat is dry. I try to ignore the nervous electricity that pulses through me every second he touches me. It's easy to be brave when they're not my fears. I let my hands drop and casually wipe them on my jeans, hoping he doesn't notice. If he does, he doesn't say so. He laces his fingers with mine.
Come on, he says. I have something else to show you.
Chapter 26. Hand in hand, we walk toward the pit. I monitor the pressure of my hand carefully. One minute, I feel like I'm not gripping hard enough, and the next, I'm squeezing too hard. I never used to understand why people bothered to hold hands as they walked. But then he runs one of his fingertips down my palm, and I shiver and understand it completely. So, I latch on the last logical thought I remember. Four fears. Four fears then, four fears now, he says, nodding. They haven't changed, so I keep going in there, but I still haven't made any progress. You can't be fearless, remember? I say. Because you still care about things. About your life. I know. We walk along the edge of the pit on a narrow path that leads to the rocks at the bottom of the chasm. I've never noticed it before. It blended in with the rock wall. But Tobias seems to know it well. I don't want to ruin the moment, but I have to know about his aptitude test. I have to know if he's divergent. You were going to tell me about your aptitude results, I say. Ah. He scratches the back of his neck with his free hand. Does it matter? Yes. I want to know. How demanding you are. He smiles. We reach the end of the path and stand at the bottom of the chasm, where the rocks form unsteady ground, rising up at harsh angles from the rushing water. He leads me up and down, across small gaps and over angular ridges. My shoes cling to the rough rock. The soles of my shoes mark each rock with a wet footprint. He finds a relatively flat rock near the side, where the current isn't strong, and sits down, his feet dangling over the edge. I sit beside him. He seems comfortable here, inches above the hazardous water. He releases my hand. I look at the jagged edge of the rock. These are things I don't tell people, you know. Not even my friends, he says. I lace my fingers together and clench. This is the perfect place for him to tell me that he is divergent, if indeed that's what he is. The roar of the chasm ensures that we won't be overheard. I don't know why the thought makes me so nervous. My result was as expected, he says. Abnegation. Oh, something inside me deflates. I am wrong about him. But I had assumed that if he was not divergent, he must have gotten a dauntless result. And technically, I also got an abnegation result, according to the system. Did the same thing happen to him? And if that's true, why isn't he telling me the truth? But you chose dauntless anyway? I say. Out of necessity. Why did you have to leave? His eyes dart away from mine, across the space in front of him, as if searching the air for an answer. He doesn't need to give one. I still feel the ghost of his stinging belt on my wrist. You had to get away from your dad, I say. Is that why you don't want to be a dauntless leader? Because if you were, you might have to see him again? He lifts a shoulder. That, and I've always felt that I don't quite belong among the dauntless. Not the way they are now, anyway. But you're incredible, I say. I pause and clear my throat. I mean, by dauntless standards, four fears is unheard of. How could you not belong here? He shrugs. He doesn't seem to care about his talent or his status among the dauntless. And that is what I would expect from the abnegation. I am not sure what to make of that. He says, I have a theory that selflessness and bravery aren't all that different. All your life you've been training to forget yourself. So when you're in danger, it becomes your first instinct. I could belong in abnegation just as easily. Suddenly I feel heavy. A lifetime of training wasn't enough for me. My first instinct is still self-preservation. Yeah, well, I say. I left abnegation because I wasn't selfless enough, no matter how hard I tried to be. That's not entirely true. He smiles at me. That girl who let someone throw knives at her to spare a friend, who hit my dad with a belt to protect me. That selfless girl, that's not you. He
He's figured out more about me than I have. And even though it seems impossible that he could feel something for me, given all that I'm not, maybe it isn't. I frown at him.
You've been paying close attention, haven't you?
I like to observe people.
Maybe you were cut out for candor, Four.
Because you're a terrible liar. He puts his hand on the rock next to him, his fingers lining up with mine. I look down at our hands. He has long, narrow fingers, hands made for fine, deft movements. Not dauntless hands, which should be thick and tough and ready to break things.
Fine.
He leans his face closer to mine, his eyes focusing on my chin and my lips and my nose.
I watched you because I like you.
He says it plainly, boldly, and his eyes flick up to mine.
And don't call me Four, okay?
It's nice to hear my name again.
Just like that, he has finally declared himself, and I don't know how to respond.
My cheeks warm, and all I can think to say is,
but you're older than I am.
Tobias? He smiles at me.
Yes, that whopping 2-year gap really is insurmountable, isn't it?
I'm not trying to be self-deprecating, I say. I just don't get it. I'm younger. Not pretty.
He laughs, a deep laugh that sounds like it came from deep inside him, and touches his lips to my temple.
Don't pretend, I say breathily. You know I'm not. I'm not ugly, but I am certainly not pretty.
Fine. You're not pretty.
So?
He kisses my cheek.
I like how you look. You're deadly smart. You're brave.
And even though you found out about Marcus?
His voice softens.
You aren't giving me that look. Like I'm a kicked puppy or something.
Well, I say,
you're not. For a second his dark eyes are on mine, and he's quiet. Then he touches my face and leans in close, brushing my lips with his. The river roars, and I feel it spray on my ankles. He grins and presses his mouth to mine. I tense up at first, unsure of myself. So when he pulls away, I'm sure I did something wrong, or badly. But he takes my face in his hands, his fingers strong against my skin, and kisses me again, firmer this time, more certain. I wrap an arm around him, sliding my hand up his neck and into his short hair. For a few minutes we kiss, deep in the chasm, with the roar of water all around us. And when we rise, hand in hand, I realize that if we had both chosen differently, we might have ended up doing the same thing, in a safer place, in gray clothes, instead of black ones.
Chapter 27. The next morning, I am silly and light. Every time I push the smile from my face, it fights its way back. Eventually, I stop suppressing it. I let my hair hang loose and abandon my uniform of loose shirts in favor of one that cuts across my shoulders, revealing my tattoos.
"What is it with you today?"
says Christina on the way to breakfast. Her eyes are still swollen from sleep, and her tangled hair forms a fuzzy halo around her face.
"Oh, you know," I say, "sun shining, birds chirping."
She raises an eyebrow at me, as if reminding me that we are in an underground tunnel.
"Let the girl be in a good mood," Will says. "You may never see it again."
I smack his arm and hurry toward the dining hall. My heart pounds because I know that at some point in the next half hour, I will see Tobias. I sit down in my usual place, next to Uriah, with Will and Christina across from us. The seat on my left stays empty. I wonder if Tobias will sit in it, if he'll grin at me over breakfast, if he'll look at me in that secret, stolen way that I imagine myself looking at him. I grab a piece of toast from the plate in the middle of the table and start to butter it with a little too much enthusiasm. I feel myself acting like a lunatic, but I can't stop. It would be like refusing to breathe. Then he walks in. His hair is shorter, and it looks darker this way, almost black. It's abnegation short, I realize. I smile at him and lift my hand to wave him over. But he sits down next to Zeke without even glancing in my direction, so I let my hand drop. I stare at my toast. It is easy not to smile now.
Something wrong?
Asks Uriah through a mouthful of toast. I shake my head and take a bite. What did I expect? Just because we kissed doesn't mean anything changes. Maybe he changed his mind about liking me. Maybe he thinks kissing me was a mistake.
Today's Fear Landscape Day, says Will.
You think we'll get to see our own fear landscapes?
No, Uriah shakes his head. You go through one of the instructor's landscapes, my brother told me.
Oh, which instructor? Says Christina, suddenly perking up.
You know, it really isn't fair that you all get insider information we don't, Will says, glaring at Uriah.
Like you wouldn't use an advantage if you had one, retorts Uriah. Christina ignores them. I hope it's Four's landscape.
Why?
I ask. The question comes out too incredulous. I bite my lip and wish I could take it back.
Looks like someone had a mood swing. She rolls her eyes.
Like you don't want to know what his fears are? He acts so tough that he's probably afraid of marshmallows and really bright sunrises or something. Overcompensating.
I shake my head.
It won't be him.
How do you know?
It's just a prediction. I remember Tobias's father and his fear landscape. He wouldn't let everyone see that. I glance at him. For a second, his eyes shift to mine. His stare is unfeeling. Then he looks away.
Lauren, the instructor of the Dauntlessborn Initiates, stands with her hands on her hips outside the Fear Landscape room.
2 years ago, she says, I was afraid of spiders, suffocation, walls that inch slowly inward and trap you between them, getting thrown out of Dauntless, uncontrollable bleeding, getting run over by a train, my father's death, public humiliation, and kidnapping by men without faces.
Everyone stares blankly at her.
Most of you will have anywhere from 10 to 15 fears in your fear landscapes. That is the average number, she says.
What's the lowest number someone has gotten? Asks Lynn.
In recent years, says Lauren, 4. I have not looked at Tobias since we were in the cafeteria, but I can't help but look at him now. He keeps his eyes trained on the floor. I knew that 4 was a low number, low enough to merit a nickname, but I didn't know it was less than half the average. I glare at my feet. He's exceptional. And now he won't even look at me.
You will not find out your number today, says Lauren. The simulation is set to my fear landscape program, so you will experience my fears instead of your own.
I give Christina a pointed look. I was right. We won't go through 4's landscape.
For the purposes of this exercise, though, each of you will only face one of my fears, to get a sense of how the simulation works.
Lauren points to us at random and assigns us each a fear. I was standing in the back, so I will go close to last. The fear that she assigned me was kidnapping. Because I'm not hooked up to the computer as I wait, I can't watch the simulation, only the person's reaction to it. It is the perfect way to distract myself from my preoccupation with Tobias. Clenching my hands into fists as Will brushes off spiders I can't see, and Uriah presses his hands against walls that are invisible to me, and smirking as Peter turns bright red during whatever he experiences in public humiliation. Then it's my turn. The obstacle won't be comfortable for me, but because I have been able to manipulate every simulation, not just this one, and because I have already gone through Tobias's landscape, I'm not apprehensive as Lauren inserts the needle into my neck. Then the scenery changes, and the kidnapping begins. The ground turns into grass beneath my feet, and hands clamp around my arms, over my mouth. It is too dark to see. I stand next to the chasm. I hear the roar of the water. I scream into the hand that covers my mouth and thrash to free myself. But the arms are too strong. My kidnappers are too strong. The image of myself falling into darkness flashes into my mind. The same image that I now carry with me in my nightmares. I scream again. I scream until my throat hurts, and I squeeze hot tears from my eyes. I knew they would come back for me. I knew they would try again. The first time was not enough. I scream again, not for help, because no one will help me, but because that's what you do when you're about to die and you can't stop it.
Stop, a stern voice says. The hands disappear, and the lights come on. I stand on cement in the fear landscape room. My body shakes, and I drop to my knees, pressing my hands to my face. I just failed. I lost all logic. I lost all sense. Lauren's fear transformed into one of my own. And everyone saw me. Tobias saw me. I hear footsteps. Tobias marches toward me and wrenches me to my feet. What the hell was that, stiff?
My breath comes in a hiccup. I didn't...
Get yourself together. This is pathetic.
Something within me snaps. My tears stop. Heat races through my body, driving the weakness out of me, and I smack him so hard my knuckles burn with the impact. He stares at me, one side of his face bright with blush blood, and I stare back.
Shut up, I say.
I yank my arm from his grasp and walk out of the room.
Chapter 28. I pull my jacket tight around my shoulders. I haven't been outside in a long time. The sun shines pale against my face, and I watch my breaths form in the air. At least I accomplished one thing. I convinced Peter and his friends that I'm no longer a threat. I just have to make sure that tomorrow, when I go through my own fear landscape, I prove them wrong. Yesterday, failure seemed impossible. Today, I'm not sure. I slide my hands through my hair. The impulse to cry is gone. I braid my hair and tie it with the rubber band around my wrist. I feel more like myself. That is all I need, to remember who I am. And I am someone who does not let inconsequential things like boys and near-death experiences stop her. I laugh, shaking my head. Am I? I hear the train horn. The train tracks loop around the Dauntless compound and then continue farther than I can see. Where do they begin? Where do they end? What is the world like beyond them? I walk toward them. I want to go home, but I can't. Eric warned us not to appear too attached to our parents on visiting day, so visiting home would be betraying the Dauntless, and I can't afford to do that. Eric did not tell us we couldn't visit people in factions, other than the ones we came from, though. And my mother did tell me to visit Caleb. I know I'm not allowed to leave without supervision, but I can't stop myself. I walk faster and faster until I'm sprinting. Pumping my arms, I run alongside the last car until I can grab the handle and swing myself in, wincing as pain darts through my sore body. Once in the car, I lie on my back next to the door and watch the Dauntless compound disappear behind me. I don't want to go back, but choosing to quit, to be factionless, would be the bravest thing I have ever done, and today, I feel like a coward. The air rushes over my body and twists around my fingers. I let my hand trail over the edge of the car so it presses against the wind. I can't go home, but I can find part of it. Caleb has a place in every memory of my childhood. He's a part of my foundation. The train slows as it reaches the heart of the city, and I sit up to watch the smaller buildings grow into larger buildings. The erudite live in large stone buildings that overlook the marsh. I hold the handle and lean out just enough to see where the tracks go. They dip down to street level just before they bend to travel east. I breathe in the smell of wet pavement and marsh air. The train dips and slows, and I jump. My legs shudder with the force of my landing, and I run a few steps to regain my balance. I walk down the middle of the street, heading south toward the marsh. The empty land stretches as far as I can see, a brown plain colliding with the horizon. I turn left. The erudite buildings loom above me,
dark and unfamiliar.
How will I find Caleb here?
The erudite keep records. It's in their nature. They must keep records of their initiates. Someone has access to them.